Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 23rd of February. Our guest this hour is the author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, and His Moral Conscience. Kirsten Downey is with us. She writes at the beginning of the book, she came to Washington, Kirsten that is a young business reporter to work for the Washington Post in 1988. I'll have her tell the story of the bus tour that made her think about Frances Perkins. But over the next two decades, as she was working in Washington, as big stories developed and she probed the history of the government's responses to the situations, she was referred to Frances Perkins again and again, but only by much older people, almost in a kind of distant whisper. Age discrimination, Frances Perkins had talked of the problem. Long work hours, Frances Perkins. Workplace injuries and what rights did employees have to be compensated for the loss of their health? It was a refrain in Frances Perkins' life. And the list goes on. She tells in the incredible story of when she first met FDR, and he was considering her to be Secretary of Labor, and she just blurted out all these incredible ideas that she had, which seemed like pipe dreams, but they were enacted and became such a significant part of the New Deal. Her story is fascinating. Her life is quite fascinating as well. Kirsten is the oldest daughter of a ship captain and spent much of her childhood moving from place to place. She became a staff writer for the Washington Post in 1988, where she chronicled the ways in which rampant speculation by banks and savings loan associations in the 1980s had led to the collapse of the real estate industry, requiring a hefty taxpayer bailout. She has won a number of awards for her coverage of a widespread fraud in which investors abuse government loan programs to buy apartments in low-rent areas. She has done a great deal of work on the economic woes which affect all of us right now. And she has spent a significant amount of time, of course, on this book. She was awarded a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard in 2000, and she shared in the 2008 Pulitzer Prize awarded to the Post staff for its coverage of the Virginia Tech shootings. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I did have a Facebook message from somebody who read the book and just loved it, and it's hard not to because of Kirsten's writing and because of the fascinating story of Frances Perkins. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and if you are joining us by email, that's talk@wpr.org. Kirsten Downey, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me today, and I must start here by telling you how much I appreciate talking to a Wisconsin audience, because your fine state is so key to so many of the programs that we're depending on now. Sort of a lot of the key programs of the New Deal really originated in Wisconsin.
All right. There's
so thank you, Wisconsin.
Of course. And there's the next book, Kirsten.
right.
We'll do an interview then. Aren't you glad you discovered Frances Perkins?
I feel
oh my goodness.
Fortunate. I know. I feel like I got mentored by her in studying her life.
I'll bet.
And, of course, when I first started on the book in 1988, I didn't even know who she was. I'd never heard of her, even though I'd taken a lot of history courses in college. People were always so focused on FDR and the circle of men around him that somehow Frances Perkins got overlooked. I became a business reporter and was hired onto the Washington Post in 1988, and I took that tour bus tour that everybody loves to take in Washington, the loop of all the monuments. And I saw that there was the Frances Perkins Department of Labor, Frances with an E. And I went, oh my goodness, there's a big building named after a woman. And I was really fascinated then, who is this woman that, you know, merited something like this? And I've never even heard of her. And as we looped down around the mall, the tour bus driver finally told us who she was, and here's how he said it. What American woman had the worst childbirth experience? Frances Perkins. She spent 12 years in labor.
Now
everyone laughed, and I kind of laughed too, but I also thought, my goodness, you know, well, first of all, the feminist part of me, you know, it was that embarrassed laugh that
yes,
women do.
Yes.
And it was funny, but I started to say, who was this person? And anyone who's been to Washington has seen how big that Labor Department building is. This was obviously, in the 70s when the building was dedicated, there was a very great awareness at that time of who she was. But over the decades, her name had gotten forgotten, almost gotten erased.
Isn't that terrible? Because it is such a story. Everybody should know her story.
Yes.
Her early story as well.
A visionary. She was a visionary.
Yes.
And incredibly effective.
Yes.
And at a time that we all have sort of become discouraged about the ability of the federal government to get things done, it's enormously heartening to track how someone did it in a time when people were even more discouraged than we are now.
Before we go back to her early years, which I find almost as fascinating as her years as Labor Secretary, tell us the moment where she is meeting FDR because he's going to ask her to be Secretary of Labor, and she knows that he is. But this woman who gives this powerful presentation to the president-elect about exactly what needs to happen, all these huge, grand programs.
That's right. And what's really interesting is, to put it in context, remember, FDR ran, his campaign didn't pledge any of the things he ended up doing. In fact, he ran on a balanced budget platform. But Francis Perkins had his enormous trust for some years before this. And this is important to remember. She had been his industrial commissioner when he was governor. She'd first met him in 1910. So on this night in 1932, when he calls her to talk to him, and he's in his townhouse in New York City preparing to take on the presidency, and it's a terrible time. You know, banks are shutting down. The unemployment rate is 30%. People are panicked and terrified, and he calls her in to talk to him about taking the job as Secretary of Labor. She has real reservations about it. She knows it's going to be a very tough thing to do personally, that she'll suffer a lot. But she pulls herself together, and she puts together this list of about 10 items that she says are her absolute requirements before she'll take the job, and they're really an extensive list, but I'll just say it quickly. But
sure.
A 40-hour work week, a minimum wage, workers' compensation, unemployment compensation, a federal law banning child labor, direct federal aid for unemployment relief, a revitalized public employment service, Social Security, and national health insurance.
Oh, my.
Now you'll see that she got almost all those items. Remarkably accomplished.
Yes. And you have to wonder how much she really set the agenda for the New Deal, because you say, when you describe that meeting, too, that she really didn't know who FDR was. She wasn't sure whether he shared her goals.
Well, that's right. Well, FDR was an idealistic person, but he was also a very pragmatic politician, and he could be very self-serving. She didn't know if he would really put his shoulder to the wheel. And she knew that the opposition to all of these programs would be very great. The programs would have to be very carefully crafted, very well administered, and very well understood, explained to the American people. And she needed to know she'd have his full support. Once he promised to give her that full support, she accepted his offer and agreed to become the first woman cabinet officer and his Secretary of Labor.
So let's talk about how all of that developed in her. It was an unlikely champion of the rights of the poor and the unemployed and safety, et cetera, because she came from a fairly privileged background, but she just walked out of it and went to Hull House and worked with prostitutes in Philadelphia. She just walked pretty far from home.
Right. Well, she came from, I guess you might say, she was not of the wealth of, say, FDR, but definitely from a privileged position. She's upper middle class, from Massachusetts. Her family was originally from Maine. In fact, the old family homestead is still there in New Castle, Maine. The family had migrated down to Worcester, Massachusetts, and looking for better opportunities. Her father had opened a stationery store there that was successful. And it was successful enough that they were able to send her to college. And, you know, really, we need to remember how remarkable the achievements of women have been in the past century. When she went to college, only 3% of women
went
to college. So she went to college. She She became a teacher, which was one of the few things then that a woman could do. She began volunteering at Hull House and then became a social worker. And you're right, ended up doing some things that would have curled her mother's hair.
Yes.
If she knew what Frances was up to. One of the early things is abuse as sort of a sexual trafficking. She was investigating sexual trafficking of women in Philadelphia. Not a new problem.
Right.
Right. And then went on and got her master's degree at Columbia, studied business at the Wharton Business School as well, and went to work at the National Consumers League in New York, which was investigating labor and workplace conditions in the state. The thing that was a real huge turning point, though, was that she was a witness at the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire.
Oh, my gosh. And you write about that. It's a horrifying fire. Horrifying.
Terrible. Yeah, right.
And it determined the course of the rest of her life, really.
It really did, because this is her first experience at recognizing a problem, studying it, thinking carefully about how the problem can be solved, bringing all the parties to the table to discuss it, and coming up with solutions. So this is when she's only 31 years old, and she essentially crafts what has become our International Fire Safety Code, really globally.
And tell us a little about that fire. That's not remembered very well in history either. She witnessed that, didn't she?
She witnessed it. There'd been a very big increase in immigration. Actually, there's a lot of amazing parallels between Frances Perkins' time and our own. There'd been a very big surge of immigration. A lot of immigrants were working in very bad conditions. There was a sweatshop, essentially, a garment factory, operating on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors at that point was a high-rise in New York City. And the fire broke out on those floors. There were very few safety regulations then, so there were scraps of cloth and threads and oil, pools of oil on the floor, and some of the men were smoking. Mm-hmm. The fire just burst into flames. The place became a tinderbox. There were not adequate fire escapes. There were no occupancy limits. The building was jammed with workers. And there were no working fire exits and fire escapes, and all the fire safety, essentially everything collapsed. 146 people died that day, many of whom jumped out the window to their death.
Oh, awful. She was able... And tell me about this, and I think that there were probably other women. Well, there were other women. She lived with one of them for a long time. But women who were in the elite class, people who were very moneyed, she also moved and she used the resources and befriended some of those people. Tell me about her ability to move in both of those worlds and her ability to extract concern and financial resources from those in the elite.
That is exactly right. And I really think one of the reasons that she was so incredibly successful, and something that we can all kind of learn from about trying to operate in parallel worlds all at the same time. She was very active in the suffrage movement. So there was the suffrage movement brought women from a lot of class lines together around the issue of getting women the right to vote. So Frances Perkins made a lot of friends through that. Socially, she was very adept. She was an Episcopalian. Episcopalian Church has tended to attract the elites. She would always make friends through her church as well. But she had enormously good social skills and the ability to raise troubling issues in ways that even someone who might not be inclined to hear that message was open to hearing it. She had enormous emotional intelligence, and she became very good at getting people who had the power to do something to act, to try to be part of that group that would solve a problem.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and our guest this hour is Kirsten Downey, author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, and his moral conscience. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's start with something that came on Facebook from Nanette. Kirsten, I read your book and thought it was great. Without Frances, we probably wouldn't have Social Security, although she and FDR had a hard fight to get it with charges of communism, etc. A small but interesting factoid I remember from your book, she was an attractive woman, but as a professional, she purposely dressed matronly because someone told her the only way to get men to respect her was for her to dress like their mothers.
Yes, that's true. I think that's one of the most interesting things. And in the front piece of the book, you can see what she looked like as a young woman, how she loved to wear her hair up in those beautiful top knots women used to wear with a very ruffly Gibson girl blouse. And then you'll notice that as she goes into public life, she adopts more and more of a matronly appearance, jackets, a small bit of pearls in her neck, very little makeup, her hair done up under her trademark tricorn hat.
And tell me the story of her mother and the tricorn hat. It's kind of a sad story, really.
Well, it really is. Her mother was a blunt-spoken woman and thought that Frances wasn't a great beauty, that she needed to work the best she had with what she had, and actually told her to wear that particular tricorn hat because it would tend to distract attention from the rest of her face.
Oh, my gosh. Can you imagine your mom saying that?
Yes. Frances later thought that it worked for her. She actually thought probably her mother was right, that it was good advice. But it also served to subtly remind people of the Revolutionary War and the soldiers that wore tricorn hats.
Oh, interesting.
It was a symbol of patriotism.
And to jump ahead, she subsequently, many years later, we'll get to that, but she has a daughter who is a beauty, and I think
Yes. She's
taken with her daughter's beauty, right?
Yes, and very much hopes that her daughter will have the easy life that seems to so much more often come to beautiful women.
Yes, interesting.
But that was not to be the case.
Frank, our first caller from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hi. Another excellent guest and a beautiful topic. I was aware of Perkins, and I had difficulty, since I haven't read the guest's book, of placing her. Is she, in some sense, a late example of the turn-of-the-century new woman? And there's the use of that Protestant rhetoric, which I'm sure she wouldn't have been ostentatious about it, but was she a woman of faith?
Yes.
And the other thing was, she in an inner or outer circle of Eleanor Roosevelt as well as in the cabinet? So thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, very good questions. First of all, yes, she was profoundly religious. In fact, she used to go regularly on retreat to a convent. She was an Episcopalian, and she would go to a convent in Catonsville, Maryland, the All Saints Convent, where she would actually live in silence, where they have a rule of silence. And she would pray over the legislation she was thinking about and how she would administer it. And the nuns, when I was researching the book, there were some nuns there who were very old, and they remember seeing her on her hands and knees all night praying when she had a big issue that she was wrestling with trying to address. They would see her praying in front of the altar all night.
My.
Quite religious. On the other hand, yes, she was a new woman. She had a lot of radical ideas for her day, just starting this whole idea of women having the right to vote. It was quite radical then for a woman to go to college. Her master's degree also made her unusual. She was a far-sighted person. She was also friendly, very friendly with Eleanor Roosevelt. And this is actually a very interesting issue, is the relationship she and Eleanor Roosevelt had. They were definitely friends and allies, But as we all know, Eleanor had reason to be nervous about the women who were in Franklin Roosevelt's sphere of influence.
Right.
Because he was a very attractive man, and a lot of women fell in love with him. Frances was not romantically involved with FDR at all. She became a very dear friend, and she was always very careful that Eleanor's wishes, you know, that there would be nothing done that would make Eleanor feel uncomfortable in any way. The two women were also somewhat different. Eleanor really was from the very wealthiest class and never had had to work for a living. And Frances Perkins found herself, because of her husband, who had bipolar disorder, and then her daughter, who also suffered from bipolar disorder, she had to support her husband and her daughter. So in a lot of ways, she had to live by her wits and by her own earnings. That put her in a slightly different social category in some ways than Eleanor Roosevelt. When they started out early in their careers, both women, they're about roughly the same age, Frances Perkins was already a very famous figure. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire happened in 1911. She'd already had a big record of accomplishments. Eleanor Roosevelt became who she became later. When they met, she was more of a homemaker and the mother of six children who lived, but much more of a politician's wife in a very different role. But Eleanor grew and changed over the years and moved into a far more public role as time went on. And at the end of their lives, I think it was a source of some frustration to Frances Perkins that she'd done a lot of the things, but she was forgotten, and Eleanor Roosevelt became more and more famous.
Frances also had a very deep friendship, perhaps beyond a deep friendship, with a very wealthy woman who supported her for a number of years. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. Mary Harriman Rumsey was a very good friend of Frances Perkins from when they were in their 20s, all living in New York City. She was the daughter of the famous railroad magnate E.R. Harriman. Her brother was the famous diplomat Avril Harriman. Mary was also the founder of the Junior League. So she shared a lot of Frances's ideals, but she was enormously wealthy. Frances devoted her life to public service. She worked in good-paying civil servant jobs, but she had an awful big obligation that she had a husband and a daughter who had to be repeatedly hospitalized with mental health problems. So Mary Harriman came to Frances Perkins' financial rescue on several occasions, and most notably, the two women shared a house in Washington, D.C., at the start of the Roosevelt administration. That was very valuable to Frances because Mary was so wealthy that she could really entertain in style. That allowed Frances to bring labor leaders and affluent businessmen together into a social setting to discuss the legislation that they were proposing. Mary Harriman's role in this was very important. The relationship may have been more than a platonic one.
We go to Rich from Sullivan next. Hello, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thank you for the program. Thanks to the author for the book. We really need a Frances Perkins today. I'm sitting here in February in Wisconsin and thinking we don't shut off the heat in our winter months. We guarantee that people can have heat in their buildings, but we do shut off health care right when it's needed most by people, pre-existing conditions and all that. Also, Frances Perkins on the Employee Free Choice Act would be laughing sarcastically at those who say, well, we don't want to take away the rights of workers to a secret ballot in the workplace. I'd like your guest to please tell the story of what Carol, I think his name is Ickes, who served with Perkins in the Roosevelt cabinet, said once Francis Perkins had been replaced by men in that job.
Well, he said that there'd never been anyone who could have ever done such a good job. And he became, she was so badly criticized for what she did that he said that she had been the best man for the job at the Labor Department. I think Francis Perkins would be dealing directly with a lot of the issues that your caller just talked about. And when I mentioned the list of the things that she hoped to get done, national health insurance had been one of the items on her list and was the one that she was not able to get done. Pieces of what she had wanted were advanced, and that's what we would consider Medicare and Medicaid now. Those were sort of, you might say, the grandchildren of the proposals that she had made. But that issue has always been really contentious and a very difficult one for our country to deal with. The issue of the Employee Free Choice Act, I think, is another interesting one. There's a story in my book about how it was just an accident that the idea evolved that employees should be able to vote for representation in some sort of a secret ballot. That was something that was suggested by a businessman. As a matter of fact, there was no tradition of that in the labor movement. In fact, it's kind of obvious to anyone who really thinks about it that there can really very difficult for there really to be any kind of a free vote when one side has so much more power than another. Francis Perkins felt very strongly that it needed to be made easy for people to unionize. And that's not to say that she thought the labor movement was perfect. There's lots of examples in the book of ways that she was disappointed in the way labor leaders operated. But certainly we can say the same about business leaders, too.
The thing that makes her so special when I read about her and when I read your book about her is that all of these Washington decisions are informed by her life. So she's worked with poor people. She's tried to establish maternity programs for poor women and health care for children and worked with prostitutes in Philadelphia. I mean, she's been in the nitty-gritty of all of this, so she's informed by the people she knew working in these areas.
Yes, she had she had worked with people on all different economic levels.
Yes.
And she was a wise person. I think one of the things that's very interesting, though, and it's provocative and something we should be thinking about now, is that a lot of the programs that they created were programs where people did work for money, not just getting money.
Mm-hmm.
And the Civilian Conservation Corps, which she really was involved in sort of initiating. This had been something that FDR had long wanted to do, but she was the one who came up with sort of the whole mechanism of how they created it. And when you think of how she created it, that people who were mainly young men were in the Civilian Conservation Corps. They had to come from a family that was already needy and was already on relief rolls. The boys got $30 a month. 25 of it went to their families to support their mother and father and children, other siblings. They lived in camps that were operated by reserve officers, military reserve officers, who were out of work as well. And they were able to make use of used military supplies they'd had from World War I.
Brilliant idea.
And these are the young men that learned all the trades, and every one of us who's ever gone to a national or state park has been told at some point, oh, yes, this was done by the Civilian Conservation
yes.
Corps. This path, this trail,
yes.
this road, this building, it built a lot of our tourism infrastructure that some of these rural areas were able to use as economic development as times got better. But that was work. People got paid for work. They didn't just get a check.
Right. Such a visionary she was.
Yes.
June from Shawano. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, June.
Good morning to your author. I'm looking forward to reading her book. I had just finished reading one of Eleanor Roosevelt's and her husband, the Eleanor and Franklin years, a very long book. And I was, of course, I'd known about Frances Perkins, having worked for the Department of Labor myself, but never having the chance to work in that beautiful new building. And stuck rather in the GAO building, which is a monstrosity. And I had enjoyed knowing that Eleanor Roosevelt was also a self-made woman. She may not had, she may have had social standing and some money, not a lot, not until her mother died. And but she was learning in a way without education. She had boarding school education, but she didn't have the education of going to college. And she learned a lot from all of the women who she associated with, and she gave entree to them, to Franklin Roosevelt. Also, I'd like to add, as an economist, that the University of Wisconsin had a lot to do with supplementing these programs, the Labor Department of the University of Wisconsin Economics, and I'm very proud of that as a graduate.
Yes, that's right. And as a matter of fact, it was really Wisconsin really is the birthplace of our Social Security Act, and was the incubator for unemployment insurance. And in fact, the way those two programs were created, Wisconsin people ended up heading them almost entirely. So a really good idea that came out of Wisconsin became essentially a pilot program for the rest of the country.
Mm. Thank you, June, so much for your call. Nice to hear from you. Ken from Glendale, hi. I'd
like you to discuss her relationship with Norman Thomas, the influence of Eugene de Victor Debs on her life, if she ever touched base with our great labor saint in Wisconsin, Monsignor Francis Haas, who was a great labor priest in the 1930s, and then who were her favorite labor leaders and not so favorite. She must have crossed paths with George Meany as a younger man.
Yes. Oh, well, you've raised a lot of questions here. Right. She's very much a practitioner of the Christian gospel social movement, that this is trying to enact programs that are consistent with the way Jesus would want people to operate in the world today, very much inspired and very religious. And as part of her religious convictions were so great, that was part of the way she actually really even survived in Washington, is that when times were really bad, she would go to church every day. And she often would say that one of her biggest challenges was that she would try to make herself say a prayer for every person who was attacking her, not just her friends. And she said sometimes it would be very painful to even say their names in prayers. So she would say things like, instead of a specific name, I would like to pray for those who bear false witness. So she was very, her religion was very important to her. Interesting about mentioning Eugene Debs, yes, in fact, in the early part of her career, she was a member of the Socialist Party, and her very close friend, Florence Kelly, was also a member of the Socialist Party. When she was very good friends with people who were close friends of Eugene Debs, and in fact, she proudly said that she had adapted a lot of Socialist Party practices and ideas. The 8-hour workday was a Socialist Party platform issue, and so were children's playgrounds. And she was also a proud supporter of children's playgrounds, as was her friend Mary Harriman. So if those were Socialist ideas, she was glad to wave the flag for them.
Thank you so much for the call. Let's get a little bit into romance, if you don't mind, because it was amazing how many circles she moved in.
Yes.
It would appear, and you have to tell us about the novel he wrote about her, too, that Sinclair Lewis loved her.
Yes, he did. He did love her, and they met when they were young. He was a gangly, awkward person, always given to excess, and with a serious drinking problem from a young age. But she saw something in him before other people did. And in fact, she even was involved in helping Ed at one of his first books, just as a friend would do, not in any professional sense. But she listened to him, and they both had a great fascination for going places and listening to the conversation of regular people, hearing how people talk to each other. And that's what you see in Sinclair Lewis's books over and over again. Part of the reason that book spoke to his book spoke to a generation was that he used the language of the time so adeptly. He did ask her to marry him. In fact, he once screamed up a marriage proposal from outside in the street. He wanted her so much. But he had some failings, and she chose not to marry him. He married instead the journalist Dorothy Thompson, and this ends up being very important for us in America and for a number, I'm sure, of your listeners, some of whom may not even know this, that Dorothy Thompson had gone to Nazi Germany. She actually met Hitler early on in 1933. She came back terrified, and she said at a dinner party at Francis Perkins' house, "This man is a very serious danger, Hitler."
Uh-huh.
So when Francis Perkins went to Washington in 1933, as soon as she got there, among the other list of items I've mentioned that she took on, she knew she was going to have to do some things to make it easier for refugees to get out of Europe. Now remember, this is 1933. This is 5 years before Kristallnacht and the time that... Yes. And so what she did is come up with various programs, including charge bonds, where someone here locally could pledge that they would cover, if an immigrant came, they would... Remember, at this point, we have almost a strict ban on immigration because unemployment is so high.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's been a big reaction to the number of immigrants that we had in the country at that time. Francis Perkins allows, though, people to pledge money in support of a refugee because they're promising that person will not become a charity case or a ward of the state. It allowed tens of thousands of people to get here to safety, and including a great number of the people that had gotten here in the 30s, not really realizing that they had come because of a program that she championed and fought for.
Oh, what a gripping story. We'll talk about who she married and their rocky relationship and his severe problems with bipolar depression and all of that. And we'll do that in a moment. And welcome more of your phone calls. We, for the first time, have some lines open. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. And our guest is Kirsten Downey, author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Francis Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, and His Moral Conscience. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls for Kirsten. Ron from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Francis Perkins is certainly an ideal citizen and politician or government employee. Obama says we all have to be like Frances Perkins without actually mentioning her name. And the moral conscience, FDR, wow, we sure, certainly do need people like that. In a time today when arrogance and lying and politicians supporting torture and taking pride in their criminal activities without any prosecution going on, my question for you is, what do you see as, besides your book, of course, helping, do you see it having a great influence? And what do you see happening in the near future to correct the abuses of power that we have going on right in front of our eyes, more out in the open than ever before?
Whoa, that's a very difficult question. I guess I would say that... we need to have one of the things that Francis Perkins really believed in is fact-finding investigations, that you put information out for people to discuss. And I think one of the things that we have not had happen in communities all across the country is a series of very good hearings about what has happened economically in these different areas. There's been a sense of cynicism and hopelessness, and I don't think that all is lost in these various communities. We need to find out what resources we have, what workers we have. We need to do some things to get the employment back that we've lost. And I think if we start to have people more infused with a sense of hope in their own communities, we can start to see some changes there. I'd also like to make a point about this is we're in such a world now of instant gratification that when things don't happen quickly, people think they're not happening at all. And I laid out the list of the things that Frances Perkins set out to do, and I'd just like to note that she laid this out to FDR in 32, but the Social Security Act didn't pass until August of 1935. It was 2.5 years later. The Fair Labor Standards Act passed in 1938. They had been in office 6 years. I think we need to look at some longer term, look at what are our underlying issues, face them squarely, and start to try to develop plans that bring consensus. I agree with the caller that it's often disheartening, particularly the sort of the short-term mentality and people's unwillingness to step up to the plate and confront the magnitude of the problem that we've got right now economically in America. And it's going to require more people having their feet held to the fire.
Thank you, Ron, for your call. Vicki from Manitowoc. Hi.
Good morning. I have read this book, much to my joy, and I wanted to tell the author that I had happened to read a book written in 76 called Madam Secretary that's in her bibliography somewhere.
Yes.
And it was such a joy that I stumbled on that and read it. And then when I learned of her new book, had the pleasure of reading it, and it just rounded out Frances Perkins for me, who was an astonishing woman. I was alive in the 30s, but obviously as a kid, other than FDR, I didn't register any personalities. And what was marvelous to me was the way FDR trusted her, and she was like his conscience. And between Eleanor, whom we also admire greatly, Eleanor out in the field and Frances in the White House, those two women were his compasses, I think.
I think that's true. I think that's what made it so interesting, that it ended up being sort of a trio of people working together.
Yes, and I will never be able to think of FDR as an insular there's this great tendency, the great man theory. And I'm trying to think who said recently on television, there is no... the guy that wrote The People's History, a wonderful man, Howard Zinn.
Howard Zinn, yeah.
And he said, no, he said, it's not the great man theory. He was absolutely right. It was, from his version, it was the grassroots theory. And that any meaningful thing that had done usually had been accomplished for a populace came from there.
Well, I think Howard, I'm sorry.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for your lovely call.
That was a lovely call. Thank you, Vicki, so much. And it's well-deserved praise of your book, too. It is wonderful.
Thank you.
We need to talk about, because she's dealing with all these amazing issues. She's also dealing with a personal life that is very, very hard to have your daughter bipolar, to have your husband pretty much unable to function to be bipolar,
yeah.
The medical care, the worry about that, that's a hard load.
Well, it really was, and one of the ironies of it is that if she'd had an easier life, would she have stayed working in the way that she did? She often said, would wonder whether she would have done what she did if she hadn't had to earn a living. When she met Paul Wilson, she was about 30 years old. He was quite a catch, very handsome, square-jawed, thick black hair, very bright, from Chicago, actually the one who was wealthier. The source of some of their early money was her husband had been in business with Marshall Field in Chicago. her husband's father had been in business with Marshall Field, and they actually lived on Prairie Avenue, which some of you may, who've been to Chicago, will remember that that was a street of quite extraordinarily beautiful homes at the turn of the century. Paul had come to New York. He was the right-hand man of the mayor of New York City, so he was a VIP himself in New York. They met. They fell passionately in love. Paul Wilson wooed her. He saw her charm and her brilliance, and they set out on a very happy marriage. And, in fact, she intended to withdraw from public life and be a supportive wife to her husband, help his career, and be an active volunteer. And instead, after their daughter Susanna was born, when she was about two, her husband began to demonstrate very serious mental illness, and he was never really able to work again. From affluence, a beautiful home in Greenwich Village, looking on Washington Square, she ended up moving into an apartment with part-time child care and the need to care for her mother and her daughter. She had to scramble for a living. He needed to be supervised. In fact, on the day the Social Security Act was passed, for those of you who, can look up, have seen pictures of the signing of the Social Security Act, there's a group of people, you'll notice that Frances Perkins has a slightly worried look on her face, and that was because she'd just been telephoned with the news that he had gotten away from the home where he was being cared for and was lost somewhere in the city. She had to jump on a train and go look for him. She found him safe that night, but instead of getting to enjoy this happy moment, she was instead full of care and anxiety as to whether her husband was safe.
Bruce from Oshkosh, hi.
Well, thank you so much. I have a bipolar spouse, so that last 2 minutes was just tearing my heart out. The reason I called, I've been reading The Irregulars, the story of Roald Dahl in Washington, D.C. During the war years. He was a favorite, according to that book, of Eleanor Roosevelt, and I wondered if Miss Perkins had crossed paths with Roald Dahl or possibly even been hugged by him.
Well, no, I didn't come across that, but I can tell you that they were all totally traveling in the same social circles. And Francis, there were few parties, big parties that were held at the White House that Francis Perkins wasn't high on the guest list. So my guess is that even though I didn't come across it, Francis Perkins would have known.
Thank you.
Too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce, so much for the call. What does she think of Harry Truman?
This is actually very interesting. She had first met Harry Truman in the 1920s. She was campaigning for Al Smith when he was running for president, and there was a very strong movement against Al Smith because he was Catholic, because he was also an urban immigrant and different than the traditional WASP politician of the South. She was sent out through the South as a WASP herself to talk about what she knew about Al Smith and to sort of speak to crowds. And she went to one event in Independence where the crowd turned surly, actually violent. They started pulling down the banners, hooting, howling at them, yelling at them. And it was a KKK group that had managed to take over the meeting. It was a very frightening event. A young Democratic party activist came forward and actually helped find a minister who could come in and talk to the group and get things off on a better note. And that was the young Harry Truman. When she became Secretary of Labor and they were getting the National Industrial Recovery Act up and going and there was some money being dispersed around the country, Truman was selected to head that office for the state of Missouri. And Frances Perkins was the one who set that up so that it would happen. So Truman often said later, or at least said privately, that he believed that Frances Perkins had given him his first federal job. So when he became president, through a complicated set of circumstances, of course, and FDR's death, and Francis Perkins, of course, knew sort of how a lot of those things had transpired, he already considered Francis Perkins to be a friend and ally.
Oh.
He didn't, though, really want women in the cabinet, and the other men didn't want any women in the cabinet. In fact, said that they couldn't be comfortable talking if a woman were in the room.
Hmm. After all she had done,
she was asked to step down, and she did.
Yeah.
But she remained friendly with Truman the rest of his life, and she served on the Civil Service Commission as a Truman appointee.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye.
There were only three women that he would kiss in public: his mother, his daughter, his wife, his daughter, and Francis Perkins.
Thank you so much. This has just been a wonderful hour. I'll always remember it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was great. The book is fabulous, as you can tell from listening to her speak. The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Francis Perkins. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. Thanks for listening. We'll be with you tomorrow.